Greetings, listeners. Welcome back to Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Now, on this show, we discuss stellar runs of Wonder Woman, beginning with the best run of all time, the George Perez written and drawn issues of Wonder Woman from his monumental reinvention of the character in 1987. Now, on each episode, we will have a special guest from the larger podcasting community to help me dive into the issue. Today's guest is the Phantom Stranger of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, in that he's kind of an honorary member of the network, like Phantom Stranger in JLA, like he's in the Alex Ross poster for the network, but he kind of comes and goes, comes and goes as he pleases, and he's way cooler than the rest of the cast. So please help me welcome David Ace Gutierrez. How you doing?
Thank you. If by Phantom Stranger you mean, as Rob and Shag would probably put it, the guy who comes in and like points out what you've done wrong and then disappears.
Well, that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Then yes. Yes. But thank you. I'm a big fan of the network and all of its shows. So thank you for choosing me to be on.
No, I'm
especially
so
this
good.
Episode.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. You called for this issue. Actually, when I put the all call out a couple of years ago, you actually zeroed in on this one. And I remember, cause you were like, has anybody grabbed issue 20? And I was like, Nope. That's all yours. And then I looked, I'm like, I wonder what issue 20 was, why he was so interested, because I hadn't started my reread, and I read along with the show, and then I looked at the cover, and I was like, oh, yeah. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to ask, and prepare for that, because I am going to ask you why you wanted this issue in particular, but no, I'm so glad you're with me today, I'm so glad you're on the episode, and I was really proud of that Phantom Stranger analogy, because I was like,
oh, thank you.
I was like, he really is.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, like, he's on the Alex Ross poster, and I like the part about calling Shag and Rob out on their stuff. So before we jump into the episode, the Fire and Water Podcast Network brings hours of amazing content to the airwaves each month. We needed some help running the network and hosting our shows, so we started a Patreon. At certain levels of support, you can sponsor a show, and I'd like to thank Martin Gray, Darren Appel, and Brett Young for choosing to sponsor Peace Bound and Down. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/Fire and Water Podcast Network. So, David, what is your history with Wonder Woman? How did you first discover this character?
I was thinking about that, because having listened to your show, I was getting ready for everything. And she's been omnipresent in my life for as long as I remember. And it must have been either because of the Super Friends or because of the Linda Carter series. But she's always been there. As long as I can remember, there's always been a Wonder Woman presence.
It is amazing how impactful not only that Linda Carter series was for so many of us.
Well, it was imprinting, let me tell you.
Well, yeah, I mean, for a number of reasons, it really did imprint on us, especially given how short-lived it was. But I wonder if there's also just a factor of anybody who's ever gotten a TV show, like that hits enough people. Even if it wasn't a successful TV show, it still hits a critical mass of people.
Right.
That's how they first discovered things. So I wonder if like there's a generation of kids coming up who, when they do their podcast in the future and they're asked questions, they're going to be like, oh yeah, remember that Birds of Prey series on CW? I wonder if they're going to be like, remember Blade with sticky fingers on,
And the answer is going to be no, because unlike when we grew up and there was like five networks or four or three, depending on how old you were, right? That monoculture hasn't been present for quite some time.
I know.
So it'll be like, hey, like the five of you that remember that YouTube series about talking appliances, you know what I mean? It's going to be that. It's so niche right now. You know what I mean?
It really is. Yeah.
Are you still teaching? Because you would see this, right?
So I'm not. I'm still in education, but I haven't been in the classroom for a while. But no, even towards the end of my classroom career, I would make a reference to something and half the kids would start laughing and half the kids were like, what? And so, yeah, I'd already seen the sort of, break apart, which, also has a lot of positives. But, that monoculture piece really being lost from when we were growing up and, everybody, like you said, I mean, how many of us grew up on the Dick Van Dyke Show, which started, ran and ended before we were born, but it was like, no, we lived on reruns. So like, that's a part of my childhood.
I mean, the Little Rascal is probably a bigger part of my childhood than my parents. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's a good point.
Just because of access.
Actually.
Yeah. So Linda Carter, definitely big impression on me. One of the four queens of the four chambered lounge, I call a heart.
Okay. Well, got it. Who are the other three? I've got to know.
Pam Grier, Mariska Hargitay, and Gal Gadot.
Wow. Mariska Hargitay is an interesting one. That's interesting. I mean, she's beautiful, but
come on.
She's beautiful and she's insanely talented and is in the longest running TV show other than Raw and The Simpsons of all time. But
yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know who the Ultimate Four would be for me, but if it was 1980s specific, you know, like Linda Carter or childhood specific, I should say, Linda Carter, Erin Gray
Oh,
is
Erin
definitely in
Gray.
there. Teela from He-Man. You know, just I mean, yeah, of course. You know, and then
Not
I,
Princess Audra or whatever
no,
from
I was a
He-Man.
Teela. Yeah, Teela.
Oh.
It explains a lot about how I ended up kind of the women I dated and
Yeah.
where I went later in life. But yeah, no, Teela was definitely in there. And then I'm not sure who the fourth one would be. Oh, you know who I really loved, but more like a sisterly, was the girl with the invisible cape from Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, the thief.
Yeah, but more, but it was
The
weird because it was more
redhead.
like I just wanted her to be my older sister because my older sisters were so mean to me.
Oh.
So it was more of that. So yeah. So it, like so many of us, you know, thank you, Linda Carter, for really, really imprinting on us in our childhood. And today we're going to talk about a comic book in, you know, in some part. I mean, this would have made a great episode of Wonder Woman, actually, a nice little bottle episode. So we're talking about Wonder Woman issue 20, titled "Who Killed Mindy Mayer?" I mean, literally on the cover. There's no mystery about what's going on in this issue. It was released in, it's dated August of 1988, so it would have been released 3 months earlier in May. Has script and breakdowns by George Perez, finishes by Bob McLeod, letters by John Costanza, colors by Carl Gafford, edited by the legendary Karen Berger. But I do want to give a quick warning. I don't usually do this on the show, but this episode will deal with some issues of drug abuse and some violence. You know, you and I are by nature really, really upbeat guys, so this will be a fun episode. But it's definitely a darker issue given the title
Right.
as well. So I just wanted to give a quick heads up about that. And then actually, before we jump into it, was there, do you want to talk now about why you wanted to grab this issue, or do you want to wait a little bit?
Well, real fast, it's also got a credit to Carol Flynn.
Oh,
It's based
yes.
on an idea by Carol Flynn. I don't know who that is.
Yeah,
I
I don't
couldn't find
either.
anything.
Yeah, I don't either, actually. That's funny. I did look this up and I couldn't find, I didn't know if it was just somebody in George's life or if it was, I even looked, I'll be honest with you, because this story, and I'll do the summary in a second, this story centers on the death of supporting character Mindy Mayer,
Mindy
who's a
Mayer.
publicist. And I was really wondering, like, this is such an offbeat issue for this series. It's such a weird diversion, though. Quite frankly, wonderful. Spoiler alert, I love this issue. It is, I wonder, did something like this happen in culture around when George would have been writing and penciling this issue? And there were definitely high profile celebrity issues with cocaine. I mean, I think cocaine was like one of the four food groups in the 1980s. I mean, it, you know, it's just, it's crazy. But
Right.
I couldn't find any specific examples. So I think maybe it was just in the zeitgeist that, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous also included some pretty ugly deaths.
That's true. I couldn't, but yeah, in my research, I could not make heads nor tails of who this person was or why she might have been influential in this.
Yeah, it's you know what, actually I'm going to hold off on my why you selected this issue question for a bit.
Sure.
Yeah, let's hold off on that. Let's go
Okay.
to the
The
opening
meat.
segment. Yeah, let's get to how we start every episode of this show, which is a segment I like to call the Lasso of Truth, and this is where the guest and I each grab Diana's golden lasso and tell one silly or little truth about ourselves. So, David, why don't you go first?
All right. This does not paint me in a good light, but it's really more what you really have more of. I find that it's more of like a lasso of confession more than truth. I find in
It does end
for
up
your
going that
guest.
direction.
I was about 4 years old and I went to a private school. So the kids that were in my neighborhood were not the kids, and my neighborhood friends were not my school friends, right? So one Saturday morning, I am transported by my mom, and I think we're going to the mall, which is what we did. We went shopping every Saturday with my grandmother, but it was just me and my mom, so I know what was happening. And then I get dropped off at this kid's house, and I couldn't tell you who this kid was, but apparently we went to school together, and he was having a birthday party, and I was invited, and I'm the only kid there. And this kid's name is Trevor, but he can't pronounce his R, so everything's Tuevo. Tuevo
Oh
this, Tuevo that. And he calls everybody a copycatter. Anytime you did something, you're the copycatter. So my mom drops me off. I have no idea what's happening. And within 5 minutes, I can't stand this kid.
yeah, I already can't stand him.
He's like, "You're a copycat." He liked the Smurfs. I like the Smurfs too. So he says, "You're a copycatter." So he shows me a Smurf collection, and in his Smurf collection is an astronaut Smurf. Now, for years, there was nothing I wanted to be more than an astronaut. So I thought, oh, wow, that's really cool. And I said, you know what, Trevor? I have that piece too. He says, oh, you're a copycatter. I said, no, I've had that piece for like months. He says, oh, I'm the copycatter. So then you know what I do? I pocket his toy.
Oh no.
Yeah, I steal it. And then so it's in my pocket. And you know, kids' pockets are not deep and
No.
they're pretty shallow.
Yeah.
So this thing's probably like poking half out or whatever. And I'm just tucking it under my shirt the whole time. And then he has two other kids show up, another kid I don't know, and one kid I know. And we're forced to wear these Big Bird masks, but they're really just like plates. They're thin cardboard masks. And he had a costume version of Big Bird that he came out wearing it like the Big Bird costume with a much better mask. So we're all there, and I turned to the other kid I know named Cindy. I'm like, "What's going on? Who is he?" And she says, "I don't know either. We just go to the same school." So it was this sad, really sad birthday party with me and three other kids, two of whom I don't know, I never see them again either. And a mom who's just, you know, who invited a kid who's a thief.
Oh my God.
Speaking of your Dungeons and Dragons thief, that's I stole this kid's,
Okay, so
stole this kid's.
you did take it home. You got away
I
with
took it
it?
home. Yeah, I as a souvenir, and I was like the whole way I'm asking my mom, "Why did you do this? What the what is happening? Why I don't know this kid. Why am I going to this? Why?" But yeah.
That is so
So
funny.
I
Did
stole it.
your family, your parents ever find out you stole it?
No,
Oh
no.
my gosh.
And I
Because that
played
would
with
have.
it so much the helmet broke in two.
Oh no.
But yeah, that's what you get, Trevor.
That is really, I mean, look, I feel bad in a way that you like went to this kid's house and stole a beloved toy, but it sounds like it was a well-deserved. I mean, this was
I was
definitely, I mean,
punished.
you were effectively kidnapped.
I think so.
You were effectively kidnapped for like 2 or 3 hours and
It could have
just,
been 20 minutes. You know, kid time is so
oh my
weird.
God.
But I.
That is so funny. That is really funny. I do have a couple memories like that too, where like suddenly there was like a kid sleeping over, and I was like, "Mom, I don't even know this kid." She's like, "No, he's in your class at school." And I was like, "I don't know that he is. Like, I don't. I was like, I don't. I guess we're sharing a bed tonight. Like,
Yeah.
yeah, cool. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
yeah, that is so funny. Oh my God, that's
Play
awesome.
dates. Yeah.
Yeah, that is great. That's a okay. Well, okay, it's my turn. I'm gonna grab the magic lasso. I'm also gonna talk about being a kid, but in this case, I didn't steal anything. Maybe a little some little magic was stolen from me. So, since the cover of this issue is a newspaper story, and we'll talk about that in a moment. It put me in the mood of a story about newspapers. So when I was in third, I think second or third grade, my elementary school class took a field trip to the old person's home up the street. Like I remember we all walked there and we spread out and we read books to the elderly, which is, you know, in concept a sweet thing, but when you're the kid having to do it, a little weird. Well, I was such a good reader that they took my picture reading to this group and I was on the story. I was the picture in the story, me reading to a bunch of elderly people. It wasn't the front page, but it was a picture in the story. Well, the irony is when the reporter asked me, like, why are you such a good reader? You know, what made you such a good reader? I told her it was because I read comic books. And I was like, I read Spider-Man, I read X-Men, I have all these comic books. My favorite comic, you know, my first comic book was G.I. Joe 10. Like, you know, I'm a little kid, I'm just talking comics, comics, comics. And I remember my teacher rushing over and then like cajoling me, being like, "Well, yeah, Sean, you read comic books, but what else do you read? Like, didn't I see you reading Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe the other day?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, I like the Narnia books, and I like Super Fudge and Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, and you know those Judy Blume books." And so the teacher then apparently like walks off with the reporter. I don't think anything of it. And then the story comes out, and there's a whole little section in it which is super sweet about me and why I'm such a good reader, and it does not mention a single thing about comic books. So apparently my teacher was so embarrassed that my high level of literacy was from comic books that it was erased from the record. It was comic book erasure. And so I'm not very happy with that teacher whose name I don't remember, and or that reporter or the paper whose names I don't remember. My mom actually, interestingly, still has the article. When I was coming up with this lasso of truth moment, I called my mom and I'm like, "Mom, I'm like, I didn't imagine this, right?" And she's like, "No, I have the article. It's in one of my photo albums." And I'm like, "Oh, okay,
Oh.
cool. Like, I'll have to grab that at some point." But yeah, total comic book erasure. So
See,
shame
that's the
on my
fault of the
teacher.
reporter.
It is actually because it's inaccurate, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I fully agree. I actually was, interestingly, was in the paper again many, many decades later when I was
Oh, I'm sure you were in
teaching.
a lot of papers, Sean.
Well, I mean, I've been in some crime reports. I've
Skeeter
been some, you know, under some aliases and some of the
LaRue.
ski. That's Such a great name. And interestingly, I went to the same comic book store in Phoenix for decades, actually, and they were going to get interviewed by the local paper because they were celebrating their, like, I think 30th or 40th anniversary. And so they asked me, like, hey, will you come in? You know, you're like one of our more, like, we're not, no offense to our other customers, but we're trying to avoid the, like, kid who lives in the mom's, you know, guy who lives in the mom's basement trope. And you're, you know, married and, you know, a teacher. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I'll come in. So they interviewed me, and I actually talked about how comic books made me a good reader, and that I would never have a hierarchy for literature in my classroom, that as long as kids are reading, that's all I care about, and that I like Spider-Man and manga and all these posters all over my room. So it was a little bit of revenge, a little bit of a little, you know, journalistic revenge. So that's
Well,
the last.
here's my secret question for
Oh,
you.
wow. Coming out the gate.
Have you ever used an alias, and what is it?
Okay. This is so dumb. That's a great question. And the answer is super embarrassing. The only time I ever use an alias or have ever used an alias consistently in my life is like when I sign up for stuff that I don't want to sign up for in order to get a free thing. So, like, you know, remember in college when you would like sign up for something and you'd get a free t-shirt? And like half your wardrobe in college was just free credit card t-shirts. I would use the very, very crafty alias of John Rose instead of Sean
Oh my
Ross,
God.
which is the stupidest thing ever. But it, to me, it was easy to remember. And I would always put like I would put the same phone number with one digit off on the end. I would put my birthday, but flip the month. And so I had like a whole little schema I used to just to get free stupid stuff. Yeah. What about you?
Ian Beauchamp. I'll tell you where
Oh,
this came from.
wow.
This involves this is a story that involves sex, but not me having sex. But just want
Okay,
just I
appreciate
in case you
the
want to cut it.
warning.
So when I was in college, I lived on the second floor of a three-story building, and my upstairs neighbors were a very loud couple, very loud, very vigorous couple.
Very in love.
And it was like all hours of the morning, right? And you know, I'm a student, so I'm up anyway, but it didn't help. Do you know what I mean? Like when
Yeah.
it was time to sleep. So one time it happened at like 3 a.m. and I'm staring at the ceiling and I'm hearing everything. And it's over at 3:05, and I yelled, "Is that it? That's all you got today?" And then I hear laughing, giggling from a female voice, and then I hear stomping from a male voice,
No.
from like heavy stomps. And then the next day, I'm heading up the stairs to my door, and I see the couple that I've never seen before deciding to descend from their apartment, and we're about to intersect, and I have my keys in my hand, and then I quickly start knocking on my door,
Smart.
and they're waiting like, oh, I wonder who's going to answer, and I just say, Ian Beauchamp, do you know who that is? Is he home? He's never home, right? That Ian Beauchamp. So
Is so funny.
then I turn around, I get back in my car, and I drive. I go like a few blocks around before returning, and then they're gone. So that's the first. So since then, I've used that on various things. Ian
That is
Beauchamp.
amazing. Okay, several questions. One, how did you come up with a name like that on the fly? That is
I don't
amazing.
know. It's stupid. It's a
But
stupid
it's so
name.
stupid it has to be true. Like that's just it. Like I wouldn't I, if I were those people, I would be like, well, there's no way he made Ian Beauchamp on the like right off the top of his head. So
I
clearly
don't
that's
know.
who's, you know,
And
I
he's
mean.
French, right? He's a French guy, I
But
guess.
Ian? I mean, you know, I don't I mean
Yeah,
that
Ian
is.
Beauchamp.
And Ian Beauchamp, like even just the name conjures a lot of images. Like it's like a, it's like he would be a member of the Big Bang Theory cast, but also a spy. You know,
Right,
like
yeah.
that is wow.
That's my alias.
And you never ran into them again?
No, I heard them plenty,
Oh,
but I
yeah.
never ran into them again.
That is awesome. That is so funny. Oh my God. I've had this running idea on this show of doing a spin-off couple episodes of called Tales from the Third Shift, where anybody who's ever worked overnights, we all get together and tell our funny and horror
Oh, that'd be
stories.
brilliant.
I think I should also do a little spin-off couple of episodes like called Tales of College Apartments, because I bet you we all have some
Yeah.
pretty wild stories about the apartments we deigned to live in during college.
I was reading a lot of crime fiction, so I know that's where like the
I mean,
quick,
that is a
you know,
crime
heel
fiction
turn
name. Ian
kind of,
Beauchamp is
yeah.
That is
and
a
just like
okay. Well, now I have to
knock on
also
my
go.
door.
I now have to also go back and scour the Fire and Water podcast for comments from Ian Beauchamp that are like, this Wonder Woman show sucks.
If you go back to like the AOL days, you should find some stuff from
Oh my
Ian
God,
Beauchamp
that's
for sure.
so funny. That is really that's the best name ever. Oh my God. All right, well, let's get to the issue itself.
Yeah, sorry to derail.
No, oh no, that's then. I mean, that should be the subtitle of this show. So we're going to talk about Wonder Woman Volume 2, Issue 20, again titled "Who Killed Mindy Mayer?" And if you didn't know it from opening the comic, it's right there on the cover. Issue opens with the key question: Who killed Mindy Mayer? As a reminder, Mindy was Diana's hard-charging publicist, who in recent issues had begun to display some concerning behaviors, hints of maybe some substance abuse issues, and some bad decision making. The issue opens with the investigation of Mindy's brutal murder in her office. It follows the investigation as it seems to land on her former art director, Steve London, and progresses to Diana finding the real murderer, Skeeter LaRue, not just an alias. The issue, already dealing with the death of a major side character, comes to an even sadder ending when we learn one last detail about Mindy's death. So, David, before we jump into the story, let's talk about the cover. Do you want to describe it for the listeners?
Oh, it's a facsimile of a newspaper cover or newspaper front page with who killed Mindy Mayer and what look well, they're recreations of photographs that are done, I guess, with gray tone and Zippitone of smiling Mindy Mayer, of Wonder Woman being escorted by Julia, the inspector that we'll get to know, his partner, the lieutenant, which is a little, I'll get into that one later. And then the underneath is the the murderer's row, the four su chief
Literally,
suspect
yeah.
suspects of who could have killed her.
It is a packed cover, but I wouldn't call it
Oh, I love
busy.
it. No, it's not.
I think it's informative, and one of the things I really appreciate about it is it doesn't use, I forget there's a word for when you use nonsense language when you're like
Oh, lorem
pretending.
ipsum.
Yeah, Laura Ipsy, yes, yeah, who I think also was a star of General Hospital. I really appreciate that they use real text in it, so you can actually read the cover as the front page of a newspaper. And then I don't I, that drawing of Mindy by Perez is haunting. I mean, knowing
Oh, it
she's
is.
dead and then seeing her with that big smile, and it seems like she's been caught in an earnest moment. And she wasn't like the It's not like they killed Steve Trevor, right? She wasn't like the main ancillary character, but she was a big presence in this book. And she really helped shepherd Diana into Man's world. So to have her very suddenly and brutally murdered is pretty shocking. And so I love this cover. I have to say, if you asked me my memories of this series, there are like the cover to issue one, obviously I think maybe the greatest comic book cover of all time. There are just certain issues that are going to jump out at me. This is easily top five. I think this is such a brilliant cover. And yeah, again, like packed with info, but not busy. Was this part of what drew you to this issue too, was remembering this cover?
Well, Wonder Woman was, I found that I had seen one Wonder Woman comic on the newsstands that predated Bettis's run. It must have been like anyway, it must have I forget who would done it, but these were the only ones that I could find on the newsstand were the Bettis runs, and they were few and far between. So I found this comic. Do you remember when antique shops started to sell comic books when there was money in the comic books?
Oh, totally, yeah.
So they would just sell anything, including present day comic books. So I found this one in an antique shop and it had just come out.
Oh my God,
So
that's awesome.
yeah, but yeah, the cover just drew my eye. I thought, oh,
Yeah.
who did kill Mindy? I didn't know
You're
Mindy
like,
died.
yeah, I don't even know Mindy, but I want to know who killed her.
Well, I knew her because I had a few, like a smattering of
Oh,
Wonder Woman
okay.
issues. But yeah, I was definitely drawn to it. It's very powerful.
Yeah, it's such a great cover. And these covers, I mean, at some point, somebody's going to do the way college degrees are going, somebody's going to do a dissertation on cover artists and comic books. If somebody is, if not, if that hasn't already been done, and I think, there's, for me, there's, a Mount Rushmore, and who's on it changes depending on the day. But Mike
Sure.
Zeck, is on there. Perez is on there. Brian Bolland is on there. In that fourth slot will like rotate, but like, Alan Davis, there's some others. But I just think Perez on this book in particular really made a choice on the covers to do some unbelievably creative things with like negative space and color and different styles of, I mean, this is the, I don't know, fourth issue out of the last five that minimizes the logo in order to make room for a unique cover. And just really, I love what he does on this. You can tell this is his book, you know, that like he's really playing around. And in particular, I think you can tell in this cover how invested he is in this book because he's about to make a change in the work he does on this book. I mean, it is still his book because he's going to write, you know, everything that happens in it. Even when Chris Merrinen comes in at art, Perez is still kind of doing some rough layouts. But what's happened in this issue too, as we jump into it, before we talk about the story, I actually want to talk about the art in general because Perez starts as the artist of this book, and Bruce Patterson is his primary inker. And Patterson's a really good inker for Perez. And my favorite inker for Perez is Romeo Tongal, who used to ink his new Teen Titans run, but Patterson's probably number two. And so they're a really good pairing. He highlights the, you know, Perez-iness of him, especially the emoting and the acting that Perez is so good at. And then we get to a point where Patterson leaves the book. Now, Patterson starts doing finishes more than inking even. And you can see it a bit, but it's still very Perezian. And then at one point, Patterson leaves the book, and we get a series of, I would argue, very high-profile inkers who are also pencilers in their own right. So we get Dick Giordano, I mean, who's on the freaking Mount Rushmore of inkers, right? Mount Rushmore of comic book people. I mean, he's ran DC Comics for years or helped run it. We get Frank McLaughlin, massive artist from an earlier era, but you know, also a really big inker. And now we get Bob McLeod. And for anybody who's listening who's unfamiliar, Bob McLeod co-created the New Mutants. He drew Marvel graphic novel number four. He drew the first a year
Like six or
plus,
seven,
of New Mutants before. I think it went to Tom Mandrake and then Bill Sienkiewicz comes in. I mean, he basically Bob McLeod
redefines
got,
it.
yeah, he got Wally Pipped. I mean, it was like, hey, this Sienkiewicz kid from over on Moon Knight's going to come over and do a couple issues. Oh, and by the way, completely reinvent the series. So, but then Bob McLeod, probably most famously for other people, goes on to do a really nice Superman run in the late 80s, early 90s, including perhaps one of the most famous comic books of all time, Lois taking the glasses off and going, oh my gosh, you know, and Superman revealing his identity to Lois. I mean, that issue is penciled by Bob McLeod. So Perez is definitely having to pull back on the pencils a bit. And at first I was like, oh, this must be because he's so much more invested in the writing. But then I did a little research. And do you know what was going to be coming out only a couple months after this issue?
It's not War of the Gods, is it?
No, it's not, but it's a similar vein. Perez jumps back on New Titans.
Oh,
So,
right, for the Donna Troy stuff.
yeah, for the Who is Troya slash Donna Troy second iteration. But for those of you who are unfamiliar, you know, Perez has been a great artist for forever and had great runs on Fantastic Four and Avengers, and but then, you know, made his bones really on the new Teen Titans with Marv Wolfman in the early 80s. And that's an iconic run, and he's on that book for about 4 years. And then that book is one of the books selected to go to the Baxter format, which is a comic shop only, more expensive, finer grain paper, which in retrospect, I think kills the momentum of almost every single book selected for it. Because Infinity Inc., well, actually, no, they started out Baxter. Outsiders never recovers. Legion peters out a bit faster than I think it would have been. And then Titans goes way down the toilet. And part of that, though, is that Perez leaves. So Perez does like the first six issues, the Trigon arc, which is one of the great arcs of New Teen Titans, and then leaves. And look, it's not like it's a like they got a slouch. I mean, they got Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise
Praise
be
be his
his
name.
name, to come in. And so the art stays great, but Marv Wolfman himself will admit he's also writing Crisis at that point, and he's just burning out. And you know, and New Teen Titans, I mean, really fades. I stopped collecting it at a certain point, and I was a diehard. And then issue 50, they reunite Perez and Wolfman, and he does a smattering of issues over the next maybe 18
It's him and
months.
Grummet, right? The kind of trade.
Yeah, they trade off, which is a great pairing. I mean, Tom Grummet is one of the great unsung artists of the 80s and 90s. And then that leads into the like the Wildebeest arc, which starts off really strong, and then again, Marv is having some troubles. But either way, Perez is penciling that book. And so he's going to start pulling back from the art duties very quickly, actually, on Wonder Woman. And this was the first issue where I really felt it. Like reading this felt like reading an early 90s or late 80s Superman book. Not in a bad way, but it just didn't feel the same as Wonder Woman. Did you
No.
notice that as well, or did it still feel sort of Perezian for you?
It felt Perezian, but it's such a one-off too that it's kind of its own entity, I think. The book has its own, this issue, I should say, has its own identity that's separate from the rest of the run.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And that I think makes it okay to actually have a bit of a different art style. You can tell it's still Perez on layouts because there are
Right.
pages with like 19 panels.
20 panels.
Yeah, I'm sure Bob McLeod was like, thanks, man. He's like, you sure you don't want to call up Chris Claremont and get some word bubble balloons in there too? But it's noticeable, but not in a negative light for me. So just something I wanted to kind of point out.
Well,
So,
right. He's on the book in like four more issues, right?
as artist, yeah,
Yeah.
he'll write the book until 62, 61, 62.
But it's
But
Marinan
no,
that comes in and
yeah, Chris Marinan comes in about four more issues, and then he does a pretty decent run on the book, and then Jill Thompson comes in at one point,
that's
and
right. Yeah.
yeah, I love Jill Thompson. She's great. Yeah, this book is always, it's funny, this book is always, volume two in particular, had kind of a murderer's row of artists, because you get Perez, you get Jill Thompson, you get Brian Bolland on covers, you get Adam Hughes on covers. I mean, those books are crazy expensive now. And then you get Phil Jimenez coming in and doing art for a while, and you get Nicholas Scott coming in and doing art for a while. I mean, so this book has never wanted for great artists, which is awesome.
Right.
So let's jump into the story.
Yeah.
And it opens with, and I'm going to say this probably a couple times in this episode, but this issue feels like a Law and Order episode.
Oh, to well, it is told. The narrative is by the inspector, the detective who's writing a book about this case. So immediately it's a different kind of narrative
Yeah, and I definitely can hear the bum bum like right as it opens.
setup.
And so we get the second big appearance of Detective Ed Indelicato. First saw him during the Silver Swan two-parter, where she attacks the Wonder Woman fair, and he's there, and he's going to become a pretty major side character in the book. Actually, he's kind of Wonder Woman's Commissioner Gordon, but more Italian and sassier. And so the book does something really interesting where it jumps through time. It opens with her attacking some sort of East Asian triad gang members, looking for some answers to a question we don't know yet. And then, literally, the page turns. We get Indelicato typing this case up, saying who killed Mindy Mayer. And then, right after that, we flash to his first person narration. And it's a sort of, I mean, would you say it's fair to compare it to like a Mickey Spillane? Maybe not
It
quite as
is very
extreme.
purple.
Yeah. Did you like that?
I did when I initially read it. In fact, I was so impressed with it, I read passages to my mom who just shook her head. She's like, David, no. But
That is awesome.
yeah.
That's really funny.
I was so enamored with this book. That's why I chose it. It
Yeah.
was such a one-off, and my love of crime fiction is probably grew out of my love of Batman. You know what I mean? So
Oh,
it was
yeah.
just those early Batman, the Batman, the New Adventures. So yeah, it was this was a layup for me. It was easy.
I really like so I like the first person narration. It's a little purple, but it's also fun, right? Because
Right.
clearly he's channeling Mickey Spillane. He's channeling sort of pulp. I actually also think he's doing one other. I don't know if it's an homage at all, but maybe more just a subtle influence. But I also got a little bit of a like, oh, George recently read Watchmen. Did you kind of have that? Like just the
Yes,
way
but
that
that
the
was certainly, but Watchmen was influencing everything. Watchmen and
Yes.
Dark Knight were, those ripples were felt everywhere, whether or not they wanted to be, right? So yeah, probably he might have been pulling a, but you know what? I see this more as a sister to the Who is Wonder Girl issue than Watchmen. I don't know. I don't know Wolfman personally, so I couldn't reach out to ask him, but I did know George a little bit.
Oh,
A
cool.
little bit. George Pérez, I knew a little bit. And I wish he was alive, because then I could ask through various channels if I could ask him, were you the guy behind the Who is Wonder Girl issue? Because this is
Yeah.
so such a sister or mirror to it.
Well, and either way it works, right? Either and George was co-plotting that book,
Right,
so
yeah.
either George was the main impetus behind Dick Grayson's first person narration of that issue, which makes it a very special issue, or he loved what Marv did and was like, "Oh, hey,
I'll do
like
this.
Yeah,
We'll do you one different.
let's do this again. But I definitely felt it. I just a tiny bit. I felt the Watchmen influence even in the layout of the crime scene, where you have the body and you have everybody kind of, doing all the forensic work, but Indelicato sort of floating away on his own and zeroing in on certain details. And I was like, oh, this feels very Death of the Comedian just for a moment. And I thought that was kind of cool because I was like, even Perez, who's as straight-laced and as mainstream a comic book creator as you can get, even he's feeling the like impact of that sea change in comics that comes from Watchmen and Dark Knight, which is cool. Yeah, I mean, and it's not, and well, actually, this issue is pretty grim and gritty. I mean, I was gonna say it's not like he goes grim and gritty, but actually, for this issue, they kind of do. So,
I mean, it's a heartbreaker for
oh my
Diana.
God, this issue's a gut punch. So, one of the other things I want to highlight about the art and the pacing of the issue is how much information they cover so quickly, because we're gonna dive into these characters, the Steve London, the art director, and his wife, and Skeeter LaRue and all these folks. And we really only met them one other time at the Wonder Woman fair when they're setting the fair up with Mindy. And that's when we first meet Skeeter and we first learn that Steve and his wife and the rest of the staff don't trust Skeeter. But it's not like we've had issues and issues and decades of these characters. So George has to do this shorthand of making them feel very familiar and important because you have to be worried about what's happening to them. But at the same time, they're characters we don't know well, so he has to do a little bit of background building. And so we jump very quickly from the crime scene to a drawing of a man seen leaving the crime scene, which matches Steve London. And all of a sudden, we're in interview one with, Mariska Hargitay and Ellie, who plays Elliot?
Elliot Stabler,
Oh, what? Oh,
oh
Chris.
God, Chris Maloney.
Chris Maloney, yes, yeah. Chris Maloney, or as my wife calls him, the cop with the butt. She like I don't know if you know this, but
I'm
there
sure
is
she'll be
a
watching Oz
well,
any
oh
day
no,
now.
that's where it started. We watched Oz together.
Oh.
And then when he went over to SVU when they started SVU, we jumped ship with it. And I don't know if you know this, but there are like I mean, if Internet usage is equated to gallons of water. There are literal oceans devoted to like John Hamm in sweatpants and Christopher Maloney, from behind. I mean, I just, it's really funny. So yeah, so we get to interview one, and they're interviewing Steve London, and he's telling this story about the last meeting where he gets fired by Mindy, and she fires him because she's discovered that her company has not has lost all these contracts, and they've sort of voided these contracts. They haven't delivered the work they've promised, and clearly that's only happening because she's not watching the ship. She's not steering the ship. And then Perez and McLeod draw her, and London's narration helps support it in a way where she's clearly sort of hungover or strung out a bit. And so we get this really interesting look, and I love this scene because it ends with London crying, saying, I actually don't know if I killed her or not. Or like I don't think I did. I loved her. I don't think I could have done it, but I don't
Right, they
actually
had
know
an
that I did.
affair.
Yeah. And he clearly had a thing for her, which I feel so bad for his wife in this. And they mention it at one point because they're like, in the same day, she learns her husband had an affair with his boss and he may have killed her. And I'm like, oh, they skated over her pretty quickly. But so what did you think of this storytelling technique of kind of,
The back and forth
yeah,
and
the back and forth flashback and having the different narrators tell their different parts of it?
I thought it worked great. It was a little confusing where with Skeeter's fate, like he's dead before he's dead.
Yeah.
So that part was a little off, I thought. But no, other than that, I thought it worked.
Yeah, I really like it. And I think it's George kind of flexing. I think it's like for a guy who's a relatively new writer, I mean, this might only be like the sixth issue he's written solo. This is so well done. I mean, any other comic book writer would be proud to have this in their, in their repertoire. And so it's really cool to see him doing this fun sort of storytelling technique. And speaking of kind of first person narration, and this isn't necessarily a secret question, but just you mentioned who is Donna Troy. Do you have any other comics that have used this style that you like?
Oh, you put me on the spot. That's the only one that I immediately comes to mind
I'll
is
jump
that.
to one since I asked the question. I this put me in the mind of Ben Urich from
Oh, from
The
Daredevil?
yeah, from Daredevil, from Frank Miller, both Frank Miller runs of Daredevil, and actually the
Oh,
Denny
yeah.
O'Neill run in between. But if you think about it, there's a lot of first person sort of reporter narration from Urich, and I always think about that moment where he like the typeface in the narration box is typeface because it's Urich. You understand he's later typing this story up, and it's that moment where Elektra stabs him from
Oh,
behind in the
right.
theater with the sigh, and you're like, oh, this guy is brave. Like, he's old school reporter. Like, he's almost getting murdered. His wife almost gets murdered. And yet he's still telling the story. He still believes in taking the kingpin down. So I definitely thought of Ben Urich in this moment. I thought, again, actually another time where I thought, oh, George might be reading Frank Miller.
Well, those Suicide Squad did those case
Oh,
files
yes, that's a
every
great
once
pull.
a year or something similar to that.
That's a great pull. One of the things that made that book so special were those issues, because I think of one in particular where the priest from Bell Rev is interviewing like each of the Suicide Squad members, or like counseling them, and then
Right.
giving his reports. And yeah, that is such a great way to get to know those characters, and it's just a cool style. I don't know that we see it a ton anymore. Maybe because we're further away from those Mickey Spillane days where people would get the reference, or more accurately, I just don't think people have as much patience for reading for text. And so I do wonder if we've lost a little bit of that, but I love it in this comic.
You don't get one-offs these days either. I
Yeah.
mean, everything is an arc.
Well, okay, so that's a great segue because it brings me to a secret question. So this is up until this point, Wonder Woman has been a book that deals predominantly with mythology and some superheroics. And this issue is a really unusual departure to street level violence. Like, if this were a TV show like Law and Order, they would call this like a bottle episode, right? It's like
Right.
a done in one, very different feel. And so, in any medium, so it could be comics, TV, movie, literature, do you have a favorite example of a one-off departure issue or episode that takes a sharp turn from the usual tone of the work? And
In
so,
the pale moonlight, Deep Space Nine,
you were ready, man.
where Sisko is addressing, he's it's it, it's Sisko's personal log, but it looks like the way it's shot is he's addressing the audience. And it's how he gets the Romulans into the war, and it's through this sneaky underhandedness that he has to delete the log because it's so incriminating and damning that Starfleet would stoop to certain levels. And he's having a drink, and he's just it's fantastic. It's one of the best episodes of all time.
Oh, that's a great episode of a great show. I'll tell you, I was a latecomer to Deep Space Nine. I loved Next Generation. I mean, it was my jam. It was one of my favorite shows. And then when Deep Space Nine was announced, I was super excited because I was like, oh my gosh,
Same.
this is already, a great franchise, and I can't wait for this. And I don't know if it was and maybe the first season was a little slow as they were kind of establishing themselves, or
Yeah.
if it was the setting. Like, I needed the like movement through space, the like being in one place kind of thing. I wasn't really vibing with like the Casablanca-ness of it, and so I just fell away from it really quickly after season one. And then I had so many friends over the years be like, "Oh, you didn't get to the Dominion War. Like, you didn't get to
Season
like,
three kicks in, man.
yeah." They're like, "You don't understand. This becomes the best Star Trek show of all time." And I was like, no. And then I went back. I mean, it may have been, no, it was pre-pandemic, but it was like maybe 15 years ago. Enough of my friends were cajoling me, and I don't remember what streaming service it was on, but I was like, all right, fine. I'll go back and watch. And I just remember texting them every like other, day as I was binging episodes going, oh my God. Oh my God. This just happened. And they're like, we told you, we told you to
So
watch. It was
that's,
so good.
yeah, it's great. Oh,
It's amazing.
he's my captain.
Yeah. Oh,
Like
that's
I
awesome.
might have named a child after Kirk, but
That's
Sisko is my cap. Like that is the best captain ever.
yeah. That show is such an underrated. Well, maybe not underrated. Maybe it was just in my brain, but it's such a gem. I love that show. The deep storytelling they took in that show was just
Right.
phenomenal. And so I had a few options for this.
Well,
Oh, go
I
ahead.
just want to say, if you did want to make a comic books, I would say Conversations with David from Starman, which started off as a time saver. Like that was never supposed to be a thing.
That's a great choice.
So that's my comic one, the first conversation with David.
I don't know if you would agree. I would argue those are my favorite issues of that series.
When Ted dies
Oh,
is
that too.
the funeral episode, the the funeral episode, sorry, the funeral issue has to be one of my all-time favorites. But
There's a moment in that funeral scene. Peter Snaberg is the artist, and he
yeah,
does
is that how you say it?
I used to say Snedgeberg, and then I actually heard it
Yeah.
pronounced as Snaberg.
Snaber.
He had taken over for Tony Harris, which was a little abrupt at the time, but then I really grew to love Snaberg. And I mean, this is like, it must be like a 20 panel page worth, like a little one shot of each of people speaking and saying one thing about Ted. And then Jack, like, kind of wraps up, but then ducks away and then comes back and he goes, "Oh, my dad would have wanted me to say thank you." And he's like, "That's the kind of man he was." And I cried like
Oh,
a
I lost it.
freaking baby at that.
Yep.
That there are very few comics in my life that have made me cry, and that was one of them.
Yeah,
Yeah.
same.
God, that was a good book. That's a great choice. That's a
Thank you.
great choice. Actually, two great choices. So I went with a couple of examples, just different mediums. I love the G.I. Joe episode of Community. I mean, you could do a million weird one-offs from Community, but the moment that episode came on, and they had the old G.I. Joe sound effects of the laser guns, and the Community cast is suddenly in this G.I. Joe episode, and they don't know really why or how. But then Cobra's attacking, and where the rules in the cartoon are like, you fire your laser gun at the Cobra plane, and then the guy jumps out in the parachute, and everybody assumes he's okay. Joel McHale's character fires his laser gun at the guy's parachute, knocks holes in it, the guy plummets to a violent death, and all the characters are like, "What the hell, man?" And he just starts executing people. And that's such a funny episode. And then this might be a little controversial. I know not everybody loved this show. I thought Girls, the Lena Dunham show, had some of the most brilliant writing of the 2000s. I mean, I wouldn't say I loved the show wholeheartedly because very purposely some of those characters are really hard to love. But there's an episode called American Bitch that is about an author. It almost presages what goes down with Neil Gaiman. It's about a really
Oh.
popular author who's really popular in particular with women and is like really well respected. And it starts coming out that he's like sleeping with fans and especially younger fans and like basically whether that's okay or not, because the people he's sleeping with are adults, like they are consenting adults, but is there a power imbalance? And the episode never answers the question. The episode just asks it. And I remember being really moved by it because it was right around when the Neil Gaiman stuff started coming out. Neil Gaiman, I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is one of my favorite writers of all time and is probably the hardest separate the art from the artist moment I've had as a fan of anything, just because I love his work so much. And then if I was going to do an honorable mention for comics, I would mention New Mutants 45 by Chris Claremont. And actually there's a few artists in it, but Kyle Baker predominantly. I don't know if you remember this. This is the Marvel anniversary cover with Ileana. It's by Barry Windsor
Oh.
Smith. And it's the episode where the kids go to a local high school dance and Kitty Pryde is with them, and it's Magneto's in charge of the mansion at this point. He's trying to get them some normal kid experiences, so they go to this local dance and they meet this kid, Larry, and he's really shy and he's bullied by the other kids at the human high school he goes to, the regular high school he goes to. And in fact, he's a mutant and he creates these like light sculptures. Like, he doesn't have a combative power, he has a really beautiful power. And the New Mutants meet him and he likes Kitty and Kitty likes him, but then he very stupidly says like an anti-mutant joke trying to fit in, and then she rejects him, which she should. But he goes to his locker and some bullies have put a note in there saying like, "We're gonna call the mutant hunting X Factor on you." And he goes home and he kills himself. And then the whole back half of the issue is Kitty basically being the only one to do a speak for him at the school at an auditorium at an assembly. And she gives this really beautiful speech about fitting in, about how everybody's different. And I just remember being so impacted by that issue as a kid and then rereading it as an adult and actually finding it equally as impactful. So do you remember that one?
I do. That's a good issue. That's a
Yeah,
really good issue.
it's such a good comic. I mean, Claremont just Claremonting at his best. So
The
we keep.
totality of that comic, gotcha.
Oh my God, that, yeah. I mean, and just Claremont had the gut punch back then. It was pretty impressive. And so we go back to Wonder Woman, and she, again, we're cutting back and forward in time. And so she's meeting with these triad folks to try to find Skeeter LaRue. They're the ones who are hiding him. And she uses the magic lasso and she uses the mark of Morpheus to put a guy to sleep. And she's just not pulling her punches. She's like, "My friend's dead. I will find out what happened. Like, this isn't like I could see Diana crossing some boundaries here. I mean, she doesn't, but it's possible. And so we're cutting back and forth between Diana in the present, trying to find Skeeter, and then more interviews with Mindy's staff, including the assistant to Steve London. Steve's been arrested. We don't know if he murdered her. But then his assistant's like, no, it wasn't him. We went out for drinks that night, and I told him about how Skeeter was the one who's destroying the company. He was selling cocaine to clients. He was connecting clients to this, crime syndicate and blackmailing them. He's the reason there were fraudulent contracts. He was basically taking the whole company under. And Steve is like, poor Mindy. And she's like, no, don't feel bad for Mindy. I went to Mindy, told her what was going on, showed her proof, and she threatened me. And this is the first picture we get of like, hey, Mindy's not necessarily who we thought she was either. And
Right.
so, what were your thoughts about the unfolding of learning more about Mindy?
Well, this felt like you said in a Law and Order episode where things escalate and your suspect becomes deeper. Your red herring, I should say, becomes like a deeper suspect. I thought it was I liked the balance of showing Mindy when she was clearly under the influence at the time, and that maybe she wasn't the figure Diana really present thought. Well, Diana thinks the best of everyone. Of everyone, right? So this was clear that Mindy's a more complex character than even Diana kind of foresaw.
Yeah, and that Diana's naivete is still very present. Like, even though she's learning more about man's world, she really doesn't know sort of the ins and outs of it. And it's funny because so we get this flashback to Mindy being confronted and not handling it well. Steve learns about it, charges off to go confront Mindy, which again, it just makes him look guiltier. Like, the assistant's trying to help him. Like, I swear he'd never do it. He'd never do it.
Well,
Like,
she
it seems like she's.
manipulated the situation too by saying that Mindy was laughing at him
Yeah,
and she
she
wasn't.
elaborates a little bit, makes it, seem worse than it was, and then confesses to that. But clearly she's a little bit in love with Steve, and she's like, oh my God, did I, in telling this drunk tale at a bar, did I cause a murder? So again, a very Law and Order moment. And I love it because what it reminds me of is, I mean, Steve is guilt, like, through the whole comic, they're like, yeah, clearly this guy did it. Any good cop, any good, DA would go after this guy because there's so much evidence. I mean, there was even a letter opener jammed into his back, that was
Right.
Mindy's, and he goes to the hospital. That's how they find him. And so they're like, yeah, you went in, she attacked you, you fought, you shot her, and you can't remember if you did or not because you were so drunk. Clearly this was you. And it's like an episode of Law and Order where a really famous person is in it. And
Right.
like they do the
Is Dean
credits.
Kane the killer?
Yeah, exactly. They do the credits. Yeah, and they're like, Alan Alda, in this very special episode of Law and Order. And like, Alan Alda hasn't appeared yet, and they think they have
Right.
the murderer, and you're like, oh, well, he's either the defense attorney, or they're gonna get to him, and then they get
Right.
to him, and you're like, well, yeah, clearly Alan Alda did it.
Not Mr. Keaton.
Yeah. I
Right.
mean, it's so funny. Like, that's exactly what it reminded me of, is the like, that moment when they do the cast list in Law and Order, and you're like, well, now I know who did it. In fact, I remember my best friend and I, we went to go see, I don't even remember what movie it was, but they did it was a preview for that Tom or for the Mel Gibson movie where his son is kidnapped. I think it's
Ransom.
Ransom. Thank you. Yeah. And there's a very famous moment in that trailer where he's doing a news report saying like, I'm offering this reward, and then he's like, give me back my son, and people clipped it. They found the way he said it really funny, and so they like clipped it and stuff. So the preview is ending. It's the first time I've seen the preview. We're in a dark theater. Preview's ending, and they go, Ransom featuring Mel Gibson, Gary Sinise. And I go, well, clearly Gary Sinise is the kidnapper. And my friend goes, what? And I go, they didn't show him in the trailer at all, which means every scene he's in, he's clearly the kidnapper. So if they name him, he's a major star, and he's not in the trailer, like, he's the bad guy. And the guy
Right.
behind me goes, God damn it, and like slams his hands on my chair. He goes, God damn, I was really looking for it. And he gets up and leaves. And to this day, my friend and I, we have a shorthand for where one of us spoils something, where we'll just look at the other and go, Gary Sinise. And so it just means one of us spoiled something. So yeah, that's what this felt like. But again, brilliantly done. And so the cops are trying to figure out who killed Mindy. They think it's Steve. And then Diana comes in. And I love in Delicato's purple prose about seeing Diana. He's like, I'll never hear my voice, my name said as beautifully again. You know, like every
Around
girl I ever
curves,
dream
strapping
of
to a
from here on
Italian
out will
type.
be her.
Yeah.
It's so great. I mean, and I do love that. I mean, you know, Diana rolled a 20 for charisma, right? Like, I do love that it's she has the beauty of the gods, and that's you know acknowledged so many times. And so we get start kind of getting to the culmination of the issue, which is the, you know, as much as it looks like Steve London did it, even the cops are like, hey, this Skeeter LaRue guy is kind of a scumbag. Let's at least bring him in and, you know, figure out what happened. So Diana, through her making her way through the different members of the triad, eventually finds out where Skeeter is and goes to get him, uses a lasso, gets him to confess that he shot Mindy. And then before she can take him to the police, he runs away and actually ends up inadvertently killing himself on an electric fence. It's interesting because while that's happening, we're flashing back to Diana trying to be of help with the police and saying, hey, I have this magic lasso. If you
Right.
touch it, you're compelled to tell the truth. Let's just have
It's
Steve touch it. And the captain's like, there are so many moral and legal issues with that.
That was
I love
brilliant, right?
Yes. Okay. I wanted to know what you thought of that because I love that part of the story.
Oh, I liked it too. It's like whenever you think about these two criminals that are hanging from a lamppost outside of the Gotham precinct, like what are they charged with? You know what I mean? Like Batman just beat two people up and left them here. And as far as I consulted Michael Bailey about this, like Superman's been deputized, so he can just bring people in, and it's like, all right, we got it. But yeah, so you have something that compels people to tell the truth, and what's the validity behind that? Is that manipulative? You know, it's a great like legal argument. It's one of those things that might kind of take you out of it for a little bit. Like, well, it's just comics, but. No, I really enjoyed that. I like that Ben is actually was keen enough to bring that up.
Well, and I think it's smart too because it answers one of those questions. It's like, why doesn't Reed Richards cure cancer? You know, like, why doesn't, you know, when you read comics long enough, you know, there are these questions where it's
Right.
like, well, gosh, you know, if her lasso can make people tell the truth, why doesn't she just stand outside of the court all day? You know,
Right.
and it really does bring up a brilliant legal argument, which is, well, A, how do we possibly establish that this magic artifact does that? And then B, you know, truth is can be subjective. I mean, we've been talking about Star Trek all episode, so I'm going to go back to a great Star Trek episode. Do you remember that episode where Riker and Troi beam down to a planet, and Riker flirts with the like queen, like the leader of the planet, but then she accuses him of like being really, really inappropriate, and so
Right.
they do this memory system where each of their memories are projected, and Riker remembers the evening with him being like, you know, British level of appropriate. I mean, you know, he's basically Hugh Grant stumbling through four weddings and a funeral, trying not to say anything to offend. And then the woman's memories are of him being like this creepy predator. And Troy's like, both of you are right. She's like, truth is subjective. And so I remember that episode really blowing my mind when I was younger. And this is a great moment in the comics where it's like, hey, cool, I'm glad you have this magic artifact. It won't hold up in court. And also, what if London grabs it and it turns out he did kill her? You know,
Right.
like, you know, and so London says, no, I don't want to touch the lasso. And so I love that moment. I thought it was a cool addition. And then, like I said, we get to the end where Diana finds Skeeter, he confesses. I'm a little leery about the legality of this, though, because he only confesses to her and
Right.
then he dies. And so they really only have her word and the word of that he confessed because he was compelled by the magic lasso, which they've just sort of undercut. So part of me is like, I think Steve London still probably goes to jail.
At
You know,
least for attempted,
yeah,
right?
at least
Not
for something, yeah.
yeah.
You know, but I mean, I guess this is the 80s, so somebody being named Skeeter LaRue was enough to convict. I
He
mean, you know.
did have a he did, you know, he wasn't who he said he was anyway. He was using the
Right.
alias.
Yeah, he had a long, long, long history of you know crimes and misdemeanors. So we get to what we think is the end of the issue. Skeeter's just you know justice is brought about karmically for Skeeter. Mindy's still dead, which is sad, but you know Steve is freed. Everybody knows the truth. But man, Perez and McCloud have one last gut punch for us. So do you want to tell us about the what we learn on the last page?
Well, that Mayer was dead all along, that she had overdosed.
and
Yeah.
that so essentially a corpse was killed. I mean, it's so brutal because they show it when Skeeter confesses to Diana. He flashes back and he says, "It was like Mindy knew what I was there to do. She wouldn't give me the satisfaction of speaking or saying my name or even moving. It was unnerving." And so when you're reading that, you're like, "Good for you, Mindy. Like she faced her end with, like steely resolve." We also learn when we have at the crime scene the first time on the first pages that there was a little bag of cocaine on the desk. And
Close
so we're
residue.
like, okay, and we know Mindy's been using drugs, but we're still hopeful. We're like Diana. We're hopeful that this character that we've followed and we really like, it has more, I don't know. I don't want to say moral character because you don't want to say that with addiction, but you know what I mean? Like she just,
Right.
it's a different ending. And then when the cops are like, no, before Skeeter ever even got there, she OD'd on the cocaine he left on her desk. She was dead. That's why she didn't move when he pointed the gun at her. It is a punch in the gut. I mean, I had forgotten about that part, which is funny because when you picked this issue and you were like, I want issue 20, has anybody claimed issue 20? I thought, oh, that's interesting. And again, this was before I had started, the show and before I'd started reading the issues. So in my faulty memory, I was like, didn't Mindy end up killing herself? Like, isn't this an issue about suicide? And then I reread it, and I before the last page, I was like, wow, where did I get that suicide thing from? I'm like, that's so weird. This is, a murder. And then I got the last page, and I was like, oh no, there was a twist. And so it's so powerful. And was that? Did you remember that when you
Oh,
called
that's
for
why I
this
chose
issue?
it. I
Yeah.
love the fact that it kind of dovetails into you. Did you watch the first Wonder Woman movie, the Gal Gadot
Oh
movie?
yeah, of course.
Okay. Do you remember how Diana turns out to be right, that it is Ares' fault, that the whole thing is it's Ares driving people to do all this and to be warlike? And I was hoping for an ending like this, where
Yeah.
no, it wasn't Ares at all. Diana, this is the nature of human beings,
Yes.
and this is your mission. This is what I liked. I liked that Diana kind of failed.
Yeah, it makes for a better issue and it makes for more growth for her. It's funny, I had the exact same reaction to that movie. And I've had this I don't know, over the course of my life, especially as a teacher, like I've over the years I've taught Night by Elie Wiesel, and I've taught all these other books about the Holocaust. And my kids would always come to me and go, "Oh, my parents told me they watched this documentary, and Hitler was, schizophrenic, or Hitler was, communicated with demons, or Hitler was blank, 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 or whatever." And I always go, "Yeah, I don't know if any of that's true. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter." And in my mind, those are moments that are trying to like excuse his gross
Right.
evil. Because we have so much trouble accepting that if he could be that evil, so could humanity.
Right.
And we need to accept that because we need to be stalwart, right? We need to be vigilant against that kind of evil. And so I agree with you. I wish the Wonder Woman movie had done the same thing. I found that to be a weak spot in the ending. And then I really liked it in this story, especially because we've had a couple moments like this with Diana when she first meets Barbara Minerva, before she becomes the Cheetah. Well, actually, she's already the Cheetah, but before we know she's the Cheetah. Barbara Minerva puts out a lie saying, "Oh, I have the other Gaia of Gaia, a girdle of Gaia. You should come authenticate it for me, and then bring your lasso too." And so Diana's like, "Oh my gosh, I've been searching for this artifact. This is great." And she goes to meet her, and Barbara Minerva grabs the lasso, saying, "Just basically, can I hold it?" And not knowing it's going to compel her to tell the truth, and she grabs it, and then without against her own volition, is like, "I'm lying. I don't have the girdle of Gaia. Basically, I'm setting you up." And Diana flies away crying, and she's like, "How could a sister lie to me? And
Oh,
how
yeah.
could a one woman lie to another woman?" And then here we are, 14 issues later, and it's like, yeah, somebody you really loved and trusted, died basically because they weren't able to fend off their own addiction. And again, I'm not judging her for that. I want to be really careful about that. Addiction is a complicated thing, but it definitely adds a gut punch to the end of the comic, and actually brings me to my next secret question, which is a dark one, but it is set up by this comic. So this is ultimately a story about the dark road of drug addiction. It's not an unfamiliar story trope, especially in the 80s where cocaine was rampant and people were starting to really understand its destructive power. In any medium, comics, TV, movies, literature, do you have a favorite story that deals with addiction? And I can go first if you want, since I'm kind of
Sure.
catching you. So, I'm going to do an honorable mention because I think it is the best example of a story about addiction, but I will not ever call it a favorite because I saw it once. I never want to see it again, but I do think everyone in the world should probably see it once to really understand drugs, and it's Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, you stole. Okay.
Oh, sorry. It's a Dar yeah, Darren Aronofsky directs, and it's
Yeah.
Jared Leto,
Oh,
you know, back when
God.
back
This
Jared
is
Leto back
brutal.
before he was Jared Leto, and Jennifer Connelly, and I mean, yeah, go ahead though. Talk about it. Why was it your choice?
Oh, well, it's just so brutal and unrelenting. Like, what happens to Leto's character, like physically?
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to give anything away because you're right, people should see it. But the debasement of certain characters,
Yeah.
it's raw, and it's something you should watch in an afternoon so you don't go to bed thinking about this
Yes.
stuff. Yeah, no, that's a really good choice. That's
You
a
know, it's
really
funny.
good
I
choice.
remember Brian Michael Bendis in an interview said every high school senior should be, as part of a curriculum, should watch Requiem for a Dream. And I think we would solve our drug problem in our country overnight. And I was like, weird. Like, I know he's being hyperbolic, but kind of not, because that is how powerful and disturbing that movie is. I mean, definitely, you know, I never watched The Rocketeer the same way after seeing that, the end of that, after seeing that movie. But it is, yeah, it is such a, it's again, it's a great movie that I never, ever, 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 ever want to see again. So I went with something a little lighter, though not light at all. I went with another movie.
That's your runner-up.
Yeah, my runner-up is from 2008. It's Rachel Getting Married with Anne Hathaway. And it is, so Anne Hathaway is not Rachel. Rachel's the sister getting married. And Anne Hathaway is coming back to her parents' house for the marriage to her hometown. But Anne Hathaway is a recovering alcoholic. She's in recovery. And as the story unfolds, it's done like it's Jonathan Demme, actually, and or one of the Demme brothers. And it's like handheld camera, almost documentary style. And it is so powerful because Anne Hathaway's character is the best encapsulation of an addict in recovery I've ever seen. My father was a an addict, and it captures that inherent selfishness that addicts can have, and this like weird fixation on their own needs over everything else. But then they're also full-fledged people, so you can also have these really beautiful moments with them of, you know, and it's again like Requiem for a Dream. It's unflinching, because one of the reasons Anne Hathaway's character has left town is because of something that happened with her and a family member when she was inebriated, and it's just hanging over the wedding like a ghost, literally like a ghost. And it is one of the best written and acted movies I've ever seen. I didn't know Anne Hathaway was as good an actor as this until I saw this movie, but I love this movie. You're right, it is funny. This is my soft sell. Like, that's how screwed up Requiem for a Dream is, is that it makes Rachel getting married look like Moana. Like, it's really, you know.
There's a musical number, there's
Yeah,
everything.
exactly, you know. So anyway, yeah, there a lot of, I mean, you know, there are so many. I mean, you know, Michael J. Fox did a movie about cocaine addiction. Ben Stiller did,
Oh,
you
Permit
know,
Midnight. That
yeah,
was going to be my second choice,
I wondered
actually.
about that because I've always thought that was a really good movie, you know, but it's just a, you know, it was so prevalent at this time. And so, you know, I think George was picking up on the zeitgeist of that as well. And
Well,
it's just, yeah, there's like a lot of great stories. I mean, they're hard to watch sometimes, but they're really powerful.
I have a secret question for you.
All right.
So this was all told through the eyes of a detective, right? Who is your favorite comic book detective?
Oh, that's such a good question.
I'll go first to
Yeah.
give you time.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say Crispus Allen from
Oh,
Gotham Central,
nice.
because I am such a Homicide Life on the Streets fan, and anyone who knows that series knows how heavily Rucka and
Oh, yeah. Andre Brower's. Yeah. I mean,
Rucka and I'm blanking
oh,
on his
Brubaker.
Brubaker, Ed Brubaker took from that series for Gotham. But yeah, he and his partner Renee Montoya are so great together in that book that when they become superheroes, I lost all interest in
Yeah.
them altogether because they were so their humanity and their humanity in the face of like Gotham is what defined them. And then their humanity is eternally one character is very much taken from him. And then another character becomes a superhero. And all the buildup of the ground level goodness, I think, is taken away the moment they became supers. But that's just me.
That's a brilliant choice. In fact, it's really funny because while I know differently, in my mind, he is killed in the line of duty, and that is the end of his story. There is no Spectre. There is no, and then Renee. And it's funny because I love 52. I think the Rucka written part of 52, which is the question, the Charlie and Renee going to Nanda Parbat, and he dies and passes on the mantle. It's as good a story as you're ever going to find in comics. And I still don't like it because I want Renee Montoya as a fully fledged police officer. Now, I don't mind her as the question just because I love that character so much, but I do think it dimin I like I want her as a cop. Like it's like Jim Gordon in the New 52 when they have him do like the bat armor and he was like suddenly Bat Bunny for like a year. And I'm like, that's not like Jim Gordon's a hard, Scrabble, fight you in the rain. Arrest you by the book kind of cop. He's not the so no. That's a great choice. And Gotham Central is maybe the top five book of the 21st century. I mean, it's certainly up there. Michael Lark, huge shout out to Michael Lark on pencils because that book is beautifully drawn. Favorite detective is tough because I have a very obvious answer. You can't possibly know this because it hasn't been released yet. But I talked a lot. So my the so issue 19. That episode will drop really quickly soon, pretty quickly here. Recorded with Billy D, and we
Billy
all
D.
know
Williams?
no, Billy, Billy D from podcasting fame. I love Billy and have recorded with him a ton. And we had a moment in that episode, and I don't remember what took us there, but where I talked about Sherlock, and we were talking about favorite finales. Cliffhangers. And I was saying season two, episode three of the BBC Sherlock show where Moriarty threatens to blow up a building or kill Watson and Sherlock has to sacrifice himself. And so anyway, Sherlock Holmes is my favorite detective. I mean, I was a kid and I discovered the Conan Doyle books, read them voraciously as a child, and then am so obsessed with the character that I follow any iteration. I mean, I love everything from Enola Holmes, the recent series on Netflix with Millie Bobby Brown as Sherlock's little sister, to the Elementary with Johnny Lee Miller, and just basically like I love so Sherlock Holmes is my easy answer. I would say in comics, my favorite detective is Tim Drake. I
Good
really
choice.
yeah he's my favorite Robin, but one
Not
of the
Roy
things.
Raymond, TV detective.
No, who eventually became Owlman, I think, at one dark point in pre-New 52. But I think he literally did, actually, in an Outsiders book. But Tim Drake is my favorite Robin. I think that's true for a lot of us because we grew up with him. And the thing I loved was when there's a moment after Final Crisis where Batman shoots Darkseid with a gun. Just it's weird to even say it, but Darkseid sends Batman back in time. So everybody thinks Batman's dead, and Tim is convinced he's not. He's like, "Nope, I don't think he's dead." And Tim gets his own book called Red Robin, and it's not only is it a great book, but it comes with unlimited French fries, and so it's really good. And it's a really great book. But one of the things I love about that book is the first bad guy is Ra's al Ghul, and he calls Tim Detective, like he gives him the mantle. That yeah, he basically says like with Bruce gone. You are the next deserving person. Like you are the best. He's like, in fact, you may even be better than him. So I love Tim Drake, and I love that. That's the thing that separates him from the other Robins, is Dick is the ultimate big brother, Jason is the ultimate black sheep of the family, and Tim is the smart one, the detective, the and so
He's the
I've,
favorite.
by far, yeah. Oh my God, yeah, I love Tim. So that's a great question. So all in all. A really incredibly well done issue, and in fact, not a secret question. So I don't even have anything prepped for this, but it just reminded me, this is such a brilliantly done in one issue. Do you have another example of a done in one comic that you love?
The who is Wonder Girl?
Oh
I think that stands apart. And also, I know it's part of a mini series, but the issue devoted to Rorschach,
Oh, yeah, and Watchmen.
just his life story, Those two probably are my favorite two, like done in one single. You could read just that and not anything of Watchmen and still get a lot out of it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's probably the single issue that works that way.
Yeah, it's the most profound and powerful issue in that book. It changes everything. It changes the whole way you see that character. That's great. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to use a extreme example that's low-hanging fruit and, Superman Annual 11 for the man who has everything.
Oh, that's pretty, yeah. Oh,
Alan
that.
Moore Mongol Black Mercy issue. But I'm actually not going to cheat, and I'm going to say G.I. Joe Special Missions number 4, which is, I know, weird, but it is. I loved G.I. Joe at that time, so Larry Hama's writing it. I don't, if it's Herb Trimpe or Ron Wilson on art, I don't remember, but it's the episode where they drop into South America. There's a country they're always going to in South America. It's a fake name. I can't remember it right now.
Is
It's
it
like,
Santa Prisca? Or is it, no,
no,
that's
that's
Batman, isn't it?
Bane. It's
Oh,
like
that's Bane.
Corto
That's
Malte. I think it's Corto Maltese. It's something like that. Like they make up
Yeah.
a fake South American country that Cobra's always trying to take over and G.I. Joe's always trying to stop. And, it's a total metaphor for Iran-Contra. But at one point they parachute in, and so do the October Guard and Cobra. So it's like one of those stories where everybody's gonna meet, except the river pirates who control that area capture all of them and are like, we don't care about any of you, we're gonna ransom all of you, and those of you who don't get a ransom, we're gonna murder. And so Doc, not Doc, the medic,
Lifeline.
Lifeline, thank you. Lifeline is on the mission, and the entire issue, the other Joes have been pissed off at him because he won't carry a gun, and he won't use a gun, and he won't do violence, even in the pitch of battle. He's like, I took an oath, I save lives, I don't take lives. And they're like, you're a soldier, and my life depends on you. So there's this really great argument about whether a medic in the army does have to also be a combat trooper. So that's already cool. But then they get captured by these river pirates, and the river pirates making fun of Lifeline for being a pacifist, basically. And Lifeline finally says to him, hey, you and me one-on-one. And if I beat you, you let all of us go. And the guy's like so taken aback by how funny an idea this is, and he's laughing, and his friend, all the other pirates are laughing, and there's 80 of them. Between them, they have two teeth, and then Lifeline faces off, and the other Joes are like, you idiot. Why did you volunteer? It should have been one of us. And Lifeline gets up and he uses Aikido, which is like a defensive martial art where you
Right.
only use the momentum of the other person against them. You never actually attack. And he defeats the captain. And it's this great little done in one issue about like, hey, we all have our own way we contribute, and we're all badasses in our own way. And like he shuts the other Joes up. I don't remember if it might be Gung Ho or somebody, kind of macho. But anyway, I freaking love that comic. And so a dumb choice, but one I love.
Also, Lifeline gets it on with Zarana.
Oh my God, does he? I don't remember
Yeah.
that.
In the cartoon, there's
Oh,
no, is that
yeah.
Mainframe?
I think it's Mainframe.
Oh, it is Mainframe, isn't it?
Yeah,
Never
yeah.
mind.
Well, I mean,
Yeah,
either way, good on them.
one of those peaceful guys.
Yeah,
Yeah.
either way, Zarana, good pull. So we've come to the end of the issue. Before we get to the end of the episode, let's talk about favorite panel or favorite art moment. Do you have a favorite panel that you want to highlight or
I
page?
do. Well, the cover itself, I think,
Yeah.
is just breathtaking. And but there's it's a kind of like a blink and you miss it panel. It's when Diana is looking for Skeeter, and it's because it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 panels. There's 11 panels on this page.
George.
It's what I call her Batman panel, where you
Oh.
just see her tiara, her bracelets, and the glowing lasso, and she's
Yeah.
shrouded in darkness. I love that panel.
I'm that's a cool choice. That's actually, it's funny. I was leaning towards that section as well because they do something really interesting. It's the first page and it's the like fifth panel. They just show her hair from behind, and the like gangsters see it and they're shocked. And the hair is so curly. In fact, McCloud and Perez do a great job of actually giving her curly hair in this issue. But it looks like a creature. It looks like some kind of like
Oh, yeah.
the way it's drawn. And that's really cool because to these thugs, she is otherworldly. She is, kind of a magical creature. So that's a great choice. I went with page 20. There's this awesome when Diana is tracking down Skeeter LaRue. He's in this warehouse. The triad's keeping him, but they're not exactly thrilled to be holding him. They don't really seem to care too much what happens to him. But at one point they hear a noise, so they go to investigate, and the panels just zoom in on Skeeter, who's clearly high on cocaine, totally paranoid, except he's not paranoid because Wonder Woman really is coming for him. And you hear these like crash, bang, all these bullets, and you know she's just wailing through these triad guys. And eventually she finds him and he's just petrified. So it's an awesome moment of him being like cocky, you know, I've always gotten away with things, to suddenly realizing, oh no, fate has caught up with me, you know. So really cool. And again, huge shout out to Bob McLeod, because this reads very much, I mean, I would say he's maybe even more present in the art than Perez. And it's a
Yeah, I could see
brilliantly done
that.
issue. Yeah, it's great. It's phenomenal. So that brings us to the last segment of the episode. Unless, did you have any another secret question you wanted to ask before that?
So we know that the chief suspect is a fan of the band Common Sense because they kept mentioning the fact that he's wearing a Common
Yeah.
Sense jacket. This was a 1987 formed reggae band. So I was wondering, who is Sean's favorite band?
Oh man, that's such a great question. So I and some listeners are going to laugh, and that's okay. I am a lifelong diehard fan of Counting Crows. It's my favorite band. August and Everything After, their first album came out when I was in high school, and like was the soundtrack to my emo broken poetry writing little heart. And I've loved them ever since. I've seen them like 15 times, if not more. I see them every time I'm anywhere even remotely near to them. And I'm lucky because they are my favorite band, and they've continued to tour even as their popularity has waned. And they have such a good fan base, especially from the early days, that they can always fill a theater. So the venues I've seen them in have gone from like arenas down to like, you know, these like small, really intimate theaters. And it's really cool as a fan. And then one of the things I love about them in their live show is they're smart. They'll play the hits, like they're going to play Round Here, or they're going to play Mr. Jones. But they also understand that their fan base is unique in that they like their fans who follow them their whole lives love the deep cuts too, like really attached to songs that weren't singles necessarily. And they have a couple albums, in fact, where the singles they released are the worst songs on the album, and the rest of the album's phenomenal. And so they'll always do like a kind of fan service section where they play, you know, really deep cuts. And so that's my favorite band. I love them. I got to do a Fire and Water Records with Ryan about them one
Oh,
time, and
that's right.
yeah, and loved them. What about you? Oh, I know one answer for you, but I
It's
won't
probably
spoil it.
Fastball.
Yeah, I know Fastball.
Easy answer is always the Beatles, but
Oh yeah.
if I'm gonna go like into the band that defined me, that like play this at my funeral, it's Fastball.
So how did that come about? Because most people only know them from one or two songs.
Well, they're out of Austin and I was going to school in Austin,
Oh, there you
so
go. Yeah.
They were Magneto and Magneto USA at the time, and then they became Fastball. But their song, The Way, hit me at a really big part of my life when I was making the change from Texas to California and everything that was going along with that, like just life changes. And there was a girl involved.
There's always a
It,
girl involved.
there's always a girl involved. Yeah. So it was that song and that band just hit me in the exact right moment at the exact right time. And been a fan ever since.
And that's awesome. I especially love when people are fans of like their favorite band is not a band everybody's going to know, or a fan, you know, that everybody's going to have attached to, because it's always so cool then to be like, oh, I want to listen to more of their discography then. Like if I only know a couple songs, you know, I want to learn more about them. And yeah, and it's funny, just, you know, as we get older, you know, you'll hear bands, because there are bands now that sound kind of like them, or there are
Yeah.
bands now that sound like the 90s. Like the 90s are definitely back. Like my daughter was listening to Noah Kahan, who I love. Noah Kahan's amazing, a Canadian singer-songwriter. Noah Kahan could be dropped into, you know, 1994 and fit perfectly and sound like singer-songwriters then. He could have been dropped in 2010 or 2008 and sound like Mumford and Sons, and you know, and or you know, sounds current now. But it's just funny to, because I heard some songs recently where I literally have laughed because I've gone like, God, this reminds me of Fastball. And I'm like, you know, and I'm like, is that on my brain because I'm going to be recording with David soon?
That's never a bad thing to be on the brain.
No, that's true. So this brings us to the end of the episode and a little segment we call Bringing Peace to Man's World, where we
Yep.
contribute to Diana's, you know, message, to her mission, and we bring a silly or serious, whatever we want it to be, way to bring peace to man's world. So I want you to have the last word. So I'm going to go first. And I'm keeping it silly, but maybe not as silly as it, I don't know, you guys will tell me. But I really think men should be complimented more on how they smell. Too many of our brethren out there still have a hint of middle school BO. It is far too common for me to walk into like professional settings or grocery stores or just places where like adult men should know better and just catch a whiff of like BO from somebody who otherwise is like dressed perfectly respectably, clearly has showered, clearly is taking care of themselves, but just has a different standard, I guess, for deodorant use than I do. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to shame anybody. So instead of that, let's do positive reinforcement. And like as a culture, let's really start focusing on complimenting men when they smell good. So not only men who, shower daily, use deodorant, but also men who know how to use cologne appropriately. You don't shower in it like it's Axe body spray, right? You spray it and you walk through the
You walk
mist.
into it.
Yeah, you spray and you walk through. That's how you put on cologne. Cologne is meant to be intimate. It should only be smelled by people who are very close to you in proximity. It should not dominate a room. So this is my mission for the rest of 2026.
Let's
Let's do better,
compliment men on
men.
those smells.
Yeah, and let's do better as men. Let's take accountability, but also let's positive reinforcement and start really complimenting men when they smell good. So that is how I'm going to bring some peace to man's world. How about you?
How are you gonna approach that? If like, are you gonna say, "Hey, man, nice scent"?
Yeah, it's going to be a grassroots campaign. The men in my life, I'm literally going to go, "Hey, you smell really good. What are you wearing?" Or I'm going to go, "You know
Okay.
what? You always smell really nice. Is there a specific cologne you use?" Or just even, "Hey, I appreciate that you don't smell."
It's just my musk. It's
Yeah,
just.
exactly.
Are you familiar with the Cartnarks?
Like, oh my God, yes. Oh, okay, this is going to be fun. Yes, I am. Yeah, go
Okay,
ahead.
so there's a guy named Sebastian, and he films himself shaming people who don't put their carts back in the right places. After they go grocery shopping or shopping at Walmart or whatever, a person will just leave the cart in back of somebody else's car, in a handicapped space, anywhere, but actually placing it in the lot, in the specific part of the parking lot where the carts go. So this guy will go and film it and shame people. He'll put magnets on their car. So I think just pick up after yourself. You know what I mean? Put the cart back. If you're at the movie theater and you just had some popcorn or something, take it with you to the trash can. You're at a ball game, just clean up after yourself. Pick up after yourself. That's all I'm asking. It's pretty simple. I get worked up about it because I hate when I'm leaving because I sit through the credits. I hate when I leave in the movie theater and I'm stepping over all this nonsense that people are just left behind. Put your cart back, pick up after yourself. That's how you improve the human's world.
Yeah, amen. You can tell. I truly believe you can tell people's moral character, but also you can tell who had certain jobs as kids.
Yes.
Because
I was a dishwasher.
I was a bag boy. I was the kid out in the 123 degree heat in Phoenix, getting carts from the shop, the parking lot, and bringing them in for people to use. So I am super sensitive to the cart thing. And when I discovered the Cartnark guy, there's the really famous clip of him putting the magnet on the woman's car, and she claims he assaulted her,
All right.
and yeah, there's a
Call
whole
the
Karen.
cops.
Oh my God, it's so funny. And I love that guy, and I am conscious of it because I'm always really, really conscious to put the cart back because that was my job for so many years. And you really can tell people who, and I think there's a restaurant thing too. Like if you've ever been a server, are you, because I do this all the time, before the server can come and clean up at the end of a meal, I've already like stacked the
I heard
plates.
they hate that.
See, I've asked about it because I'll have just subconsciously, I'll have stacked the plates and kind of the silverware and make sure it's not, and I have asked a couple servers because I go, oh, wait, I don't even think about it. I'm just trying to be helpful. I go, does that screw you up? And they're like, no, not at all. Because they're like, it screws us up when people just pile things. They're like, but you clearly worked in a restaurant because you stacked the plates and then you did the silverware separate. They're like, no, like you stacked like a server. They're like, so that's fine. Like it's like we appreciate people being nice. They're like, but when they just pile everything on and there's like a random knife, that you don't
Yeah.
notice, that's when it sucks. But yeah, amen to that, man. That is good. So
Pick up after yourself.
let's be a good smelling, group of humans who pick up after her.
That's it.
So that brings us to the end of the episode. David, I cannot thank you enough for being on this episode. I was so happy
I'm
when I put
honored.
up the all call and you were one of the first people to chime in. I was really honored. I love getting to speak with you. I love getting to talk about comics and so why don't you tell the folks where they can find
Well, on this network sporadically, just kind
you?
of popping up here and there. I don't have a podcast presence, but I do encourage you to check out. I did do a comic strip for a year with Bobby Mort, who co-created the series Loudermilk.
Oh,
And we
yeah.
did a series called Mr. Ghost Adventures. So if you just Google that, it's going to be on Webtoons. So I encourage everybody to check that out.
That's awesome. I love Loudermilk. That's awesome.
It's a great series, right?
It is a really great series. I always think of that. I'm blanking on the actor's name, and I really like him.
Ron Livingston.
Yes, yeah. And I always think of him as the guy who broke up with Carrie on Sex and the City over a Post-it note. And I like that because I hate Carrie on Sex and the City. I think she's actually the bad guy on that show. I think she's actually the
Secret
antagonist.
villain.
Yeah, and so I've always really liked him. But man, thanks again for being on. I super appreciate it. Listeners, we're going to take a podcast promo break, and I will be back with feedback from issue 19 with Billy D.
Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Specialcast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Specialcast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra! Read all about it! I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC House ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Specialcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
We are back from that podcast promo break to discuss your feedback for issue 19, which I covered with Billy D. As always, I encourage you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and leave feedback at fireandwaterpodcast.com as it helps folks to find the show. We open the feedback with a focus on one of the secret questions from the episode, which asked for a favorite example of a hero overcoming huge odds. Billy and I both referenced the famous Spider-Man story, but we blanked on the details. Luckily, Rich wrote in to save the day, saying, "The iconic Spider-Man story you were talking about is If This Be My Destiny, a four-parter with the famous Will Yourself to Lift Impossible Weights scene in the final issue, number 33. Peter spends most of the story thinking he's chasing a new villain called the Master Planner, only to discover it was actually Dr. Octopus all along. Thank you so much, Rich, for writing in. I'm pretty sure I called him the Master Criminal, but I think that's from My Hero Academia. Tim Price, host of the Outcasters Under Siege, which is covering the great Under Siege arc in the Avengers, writes in saying, "Is Molly pronounced Molly or Moly, like Billy Batson's Holy Moly? I keep thinking the latter, but I'm pretty clueless about that." Now, we talked about Moly in the episode because Julia uses it to defend against Cersei's magic. I looked it up. It is Moly, like Holy Moly. So you're right, Tim. I was wrong. I was pronouncing it like the street drug, which I have never done, but apparently have heard of. Tim goes on to say, "The repetitive Diana fights Cersei blasts cycle made me think of the kinds of scenarios my childhood friends and I would make up when we played superheroes, which is to say they weren't that good, but we had fun at the time. Unless there was some point to the repeated action, but I'm not feeling it. It really needed a moment for Diana to say, not this time, to give her a heroic moment. I think you hit it on the head. George was still finding his way writing." Yeah, Tim, I totally agree. This is just not a successful issue, and it's not a successful wrap-up to the arc. And it really is, because three different times, it's Diana wakes up, Diana fights Cersei, Cersei knocks her out, and it's unsatisfying. And so George will definitely get his chops as he goes, but this is not his strongest issue. Tim says, "Finally, I'm so surprised to get not one, but two credits for doing the math for Julia's age and showing my work. I learned well in school. Happy to help." Well, thank you, Tim, for explaining Julia's age. You solved a question for me that I'd had since pretty much issue two. The delightful Martin Gray, author of Two Dangers for a Girl, comments on Tim's question about pronouncing Moly with the correct answer. He says, I've always heard moly, as it has to rhyme with holy. I'm pretty sure Molly is something a tad naughtier. You're right, Martin. And I, for some reason in this show, I reveal a deeper knowledge of the dark arts than I mean to, and which is funny because I'm a pretty clean cut guy. Martin goes on to say, that cover is really attractive, but it does suffer from George giving us a little too much. Just take away that insert of Julia and her Greek buddies and it'd be perfect. And the drapes, plus the blanket on Cersei's massage bench, the coffee table, maybe a couple of his wee daft beasties. Yeah, Martin, Billy, and I both commented on that as well. It's Perez, so it's beautiful, but it's just busy and it's overly fussy. Commenting on one of the secret questions from the episode about favorite work by Alan Moore, Martin says, Alan Moore's best work could be, heck, lots of things. I remember when he was just working for Marvel UK and Warrior, and a fanzine editor I was pals with told me he was taking over Swamp Thing, and it was a big secret. I hoped he'd do okay. I really do love his Swampy and his Captain Britain, and yes, Top 10, but have you read Supreme? Amazing. Yeah, Martin, you have a really unique view on this since you were working for Marvel UK at the time, and, you know, Top 10 I love, and yeah, his Supreme arc, I mean, obviously, I wish it could have been a Superman book, but it effectively is. And it is, it's hard to find, but it's worth tracking down. Martin goes on to say, talking of Moore brings me to the secret question about best or worst off-screen death. I'd say worst, and that's Pete Ross's reported slaying in Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow by Alan Moore. Superboy's best friend deserves so much better. Justice for Pete Ross. Martin, I had totally forgotten that Pete's killed off-screen in those issues. And you're right, it is a shame. I mean, Pete is... You know, he's the co-star of Superboy. He and Lana Lang are the co-stars of Superboy. And actually, for listeners, and I know Martin would agree because I read his blog, if you are not reading Mark Waid's current Action Comics run, you need to run out and buy those issues. It's all about Clark's time in Smallville, about him becoming the secret Superboy, about Lana and Pete. It's just awesome old school goodness done with a Mark Waid modern twist. So thanks for writing in, Martin. Ryan Daly, who I heard blackmailed his way onto the Fire and Water Podcast Network, also comments on the secret question about best off-screen death, saying, best off-screen death, Poochie the dog. I have to go now. My planet needs me. Note, Poochie died on his way back to his home planet. I laughed so hard at this, Ryan. I had totally forgotten about Poochie. I remember in the 2010s, maybe earlier, when people would use poochie as a verb, they'd be like, oh, he got poochied, which always meant not only like it was insult to injury, like not only killed or written off, but like killed on the way home. So great choice. Co-host of this very episode, David Ace Gutierrez, also comments on off-screen death, saying, I'm agreeing with my little brother Ryan on Poochie's death being the greatest off-screen death. Yeah, I agree, Dag. Our Australian buddy Paul Hicks writes in about off-screen deaths as well, saying, one of the most egregious off-screen departures from a show was Kevin Costner as John Dutton in Yellowstone. Writers must have had a nightmare time doing the last season without him. You know, it's funny, Paul, I have never watched Yellowstone, and it's been recommended to me a million times, but one of the reasons I never watched it is because I saw an interview with Kevin Costner, I think on Howard Stern, where Howard Stern's like, why did you leave the show at season 4? You were the main character. And he's like, hey, I signed up for, you know, as many seasons as I did. I didn't want to do any more. That wasn't my problem. And then Howard Stern's like, well, it ruined the show. And so once I saw that, I was like, yeah, I don't need to watch a show that I know takes a nosedive in the end. But I bet you there are a lot of people who would agree with you. Dr. Ange, who covers V for Vendetta with Billy on a show I cannot recommend enough. Great hosts, great book. Ange goes on to write in about the secret questions as well, saying, off-screen death, I would say Hicks slash Newt dying in Alien 3 was a gut punch. It was compounded exponentially because Alien 3 sort of sucks. Yeah, to put it mildly, Dr. Ange, not good. Since that one was mentioned, I'll do a deeper cut. In The Godfather, when the mob war is happening, Sonny Corleone kills Bruno Tattaglia, the son of Don Tattaglia, off screen. It is mentioned almost in passing. That act further escalates the mob war and leads to Sonny being gunned down. Then that leads to a truce, but if you aren't listening, you might miss the key event. Yeah, deep cut. Great call. Dr. Ange goes on to talk about a hero overcoming great odds, saying, very early on in New Teen Titans, Cyborg outpresses a weight his robotics shouldn't be able to handle. He says he needed to know that he could somehow allow himself to push through his limitations of his mechanics. I think that was great. Yeah, I can picture that exact scene in my brain, kind of playing off similar scenes with The Thing and the Fantastic Four, who, I mean, that, let's face it, early Vic Stone is Ben Grimm. And great call. I love early New Teen Titans. As far as the best Alan Moore question, Ange says, first off, thank you for the kind words about my coverage of V for Vendetta with Billy. I am loving doing it, seeing things I haven't seen before. For sure, just based on the condition of issues trades, V for Vendetta is my favorite Moore work, but Swamp Thing and Miracle Man are always close behind. I haven't read much of the Tom Strong Prometheus stuff, which is a hole I should probably deal with. Yeah, Ange, I can't recommend that stuff enough, especially if you love pulp. Tom Strong is amazing. Top 10 is like Hill Street Blues, if it took place during Crisis on Infinite Earths. Prometheus is almost impossible to describe, but is brilliant and drawn by J.G. Jones, so it's beautiful. Super Captain writes in to comment on the secret questions as well, saying, as far as the hero extends himself to the max moments, there's a neat scene in Uncanny X-Men 124 when the X-Men are in Arcade's murder world. Some buzzsaw bumper cars are menacing Nightcrawler and Cyclops. Scott takes out all of them using a single optic blast that ricochets 8 times. He comments that he hasn't tried that stunt in ages, indicating he wasn't at all sure it would work. As a great scene, Super Captain. I love the Cyclops as like pull hustler moment. Super Captain goes on to say, regarding Alan Moore, I suppose that I'm like a lot of people and that my favorite among his work is Watchmen, which is still the gold standard as far as I'm concerned, and Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I'm a little odd in that I've never read his Swamp Thing run, minus the anatomy lesson published in that Best of DC Digest, V for Vendetta, or Miracle Man. I did read the ABC Wildstorm books. Tom Strong and Lead of Extraordinary Gentlemen were my favorites out of that bunch. I just couldn't get into Top 10 or Promethea. Super Captain, I really cannot recommend, I mean, not going on a limb here, his Swamp Thing run enough. It's just brilliant, and it sets the tone for all DC Vertigo to follow. It's phenomenal. It's such a great book. But more, I mean, you know, really basically anything Moore wrote was pretty brilliant. And bringing us to a close is Network All-Star Brett Young, who I know for a fact blackmailed his way into the network, saying, great episode, Sean and Billy. I love George Perez, but holy crap, is there a Greek god of exposition? And when Cersei isn't talking, the story is Diana in chains. Diana breaks free. Cersei knocks out Diana. The guy from Riptide checks on Diana. Repeat. Not George's best story, but the art is still amazing. Yeah, that is so funny, Brett, and I totally agree. It is a weirdly formulaic, but it's a bad formula of an issue. Again, George redeems himself in the issue I just covered with David Ace Gutierrez on this very episode, but, you know, definitely a little bit of a clunker out the gate for George. Brett goes on to say, it was nice to see Julia take time away from checking on her olive oil / money laundering production to lead a band of French resistance Greeks to take out Cersei and save Diana. Nothing will stop Julia from protecting her cash cow. That's awesome. I mean, Brett, even you have to admit, Julia shines in this issue. I mean, you know, she shoots Cersei. It's pretty badass. Well, thank you everybody for writing in. Thank you for your feedback. The episode was a blast. Anytime I get to record with Billy is great. Thanks for listening to this episode. Anytime I get to record with David Ace Gutierrez, it's wonderful. Please tune in next time where we're going to cover issue 21 of Wonder Woman Volume 2. And thank you so much for helping me bring a little bit of peace to man's world.